Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, welcome to another book club. Let's have a book club. I'm joined by the esteemed author C.K. McDonald. We're going to talk about the Stranger Times series, but he's written many, many books. I know it's Queef. Hello there. How are you doing?
Hi, Rich. How are you, man? Nice to see you.
Very, very good to see you again. We were just previously discussing, we gigged together many years ago, and then last time I saw you, you came around to my house and had dinner here with Sarah Millican. And you were saying that was 5 years ago.
So, yeah, I just did the maths and realised I've been nearly 5 years retired from stand-up and I'm genuinely stunned. Like, that cannot be correct. I can't specifically remember anything that happened in 2022. I'm pretty sure it didn't. I think we just skipped a number and didn't realise, because there's no way it's been that long.
It does. Well, I think that whole experience of the early 2020s has played a few tricks with time. But yes, I knew you was a stand-up and I knew you were doing some writing, and I knew you'd written some books. I wasn't aware of quite how many books you'd written, I have to say, and I was really delighted to get stuck into this newer series. But tell us about, you started off in computers, right? Installing computer servers, is that right? According to Wikipedia?
I worked in IT in Dublin, and then I moved across to London because I wanted to try and do stand-up and writing, and I wanted to go somewhere where nobody knew me. Which is genuinely my logic of literally get out of Dublin and do gigs where no one knows who I am. So when I embarrass myself, no one would see it. I sort of came over here. I think I was like nearly 3 years working, and then went full time because I got bizarrely wanted to be a TV writer. I had loads of things optioned over the years. I think I had like 10 different sitcoms, but where I actually got paid was writing kids' TV, which was... It's always, you'd be surprised because it's never on a lot of people's CVs, but the amount of writers in Britain who did a load of kids' TV before getting their kind of big breaks, because it's a way you can actually write TV. Whereas, otherwise you're sort of sitting around waiting for the call to come. So it was a great experience as well. So I was doing all that, and then I was a stand-up as well, obviously. And then I think myself and, like, I moved myself and Gary Delaney were housemates for years. And we eventually went full-time. He went full-time a year before me, and then we moved to Birmingham. And the rest is, you know, I wouldn't say history. That makes it sound more grand. The rest is things that also happened.
Yes. And so how did the writing novels and... very successfully, I have to say, and copiously as well in the last 10 years, especially you've written a hell of a lot of stuff. How did you make the leap and how did the first one come about, let's say?
Right. Well, basically, because I was sort of asked before about writing novels, and honestly, I thought, oh, there's no way I could do that. Look at books, they're massive. There's loads of words in them. And I was doing the TV scripts and had that thing that I'm sure, you know, you remember well, where spend a year on a project for TV and then it just doesn't go anywhere and disappears and stuff like that. And I had an idea for a thriller book, which I've never written, by the way. And I tried to write prose. I kind of realized I didn't know what I was doing because I was so obsessive about getting TV stuff done that I'd literally spent a decade reading scripts. Like, most of the stuff I read was genuinely in script form. I have every script book under the sun up in my other office. And so I was sort of, I when I wanted to do that, then I basically went back and did I started a master's in MMU in Manchester, where I live, in creative writing, which I still haven't finished. But I started doing the workshops and loved it. The workshops are great because you sort of get a bit of feedback, especially when you're a stand-up comedian. You get a bit of feedback and you kind of go, oh, people are liking this. And I started doing that. And then I basically started doing, which is genuinely the greatest piece of advice that I give to people for writing. And I never hear anyone else do it, which is weird, but do short stories. I'm amazed every time people say, I'm going to write a book. And you're like, write a short story. Because, like, nobody learns how to run a marathon by just going, right, I'm putting on trainers. I'm going to run at 26 miles. Come pick me up when I'm finished. Yeah, that's not how you do a marathon. And, like, I was doing short stories just to do fun, just to do stuff and get feedback on them. And literally, I started writing a short story one day. It was called The Man at One of Those Faces. And I had the idea, which was a guy is got a face that he constantly is being confused with other people his whole life. Like in the original, right. Almost a supernatural thing, which that faded away. But basically, I was writing a story about him visiting dementia patients in hospital and just pretending to be whoever they wanted to be as a kind of service. And then I realized that was a sort of interesting premise, but nothing actually was happening. And then I went, oh, one of them tries to kill him. And as soon as I hit that idea, it all started rushing out. I was like, oh, wow. And then I quickly realized it was a novel. And I literally thought I was just going to write it for practice, just to see if I could. And then when we got to the end of it, we liked it. And then it ended up being my first book.
It's amazing. And that is absolutely terrific advice because it is, you know, I've started on a couple of ideas for like a, you know, sci-fi comedy book, you know, not unlike the sort of stuff that you're doing, I guess. And always ground to a halt. And I think that is terrific advice, actually, just to, because you'd say that to a stand-up as well, you know, so you'd say to a stand-up, don't, although Maisie Adam, weirdly, her first gig was an hour of stand-up and it went very well. But most of them, and she's done incredibly well. But most stand-ups, you would say, go and do 5 minutes, you know, 200 times.
Book himself an hour in Edinburgh when he literally just started and then just did that. Maybe. Like, yeah, but it's one of those things that people hear those things and you go, but that is not how it works. Do not do that.
Don't do that. But that's really terrific advice. And at what point, I mean, obviously... these have been very successful books, and it's called the Dublin Trilogy, right?
There's now seven of them, and there's going to be more. Another piece of advice is don't put a number in the title of a series. it's a simple piece of advice. What genuinely happened with that, by the way, is I had an idea for the third book, and I started trying to write it, and I realized because it was going to be two different timelines that it really needed to be two different books to give it a full proper thing. And then I thought, well, it's going to be four of them. And the one advantage of when you reach number six in a trilogy, people at least stop sending you emails explaining what a trilogy is. By that point, you figured out you probably know. But we got a lot of them. Yeah, because I enjoy writing them. And I literally have written, like, I'm, because like the Bunny books, the sort of Dublin Trilogy and all that, they're done independently by us. Like literally now my wife works full time running our publishing company, and it's all us doing those. And because of that, I do, frankly, whatever the hell I want. So I have literally started writing the sequels to a prequel. Like, I literally did one 16 years ago, and then I've started writing books to fill in that gap, which is not like if you, a publisher would be, you know, all the foreign rights publishers, we have to explain to them every time why there's such a weird sequence of books. And you're just like, just go with it. If they're the kind of people who get really hung up on like the chronology, they're probably not going to be fans of my work anyway. You just have to, my fans are the kind of people that go, I'm just going to read this and I'm going to hopefully enjoy it.
That's the dream though, right? To be your own publishing house, doing exactly what you want to do. It feels to me that books and writing books is out of all the writing jobs. And yeah, I think similarly, we've been through similar experiences with writing, some successes and some many failures in my case. But with a novel, it feels like it's you, maybe an editor. And if you do it yourself, maybe not even that. So, it does have that autonomy that stand up. That maybe appeals to stand-ups.
I think it does. I mean, like all my books are like edited. So we've actually a very strong editing team on the sort of indie books. But I suppose the difference in that switch situation is that the editor works for me. So like he gives me his suggestions and I can go yeah or no. But to be fair though, weirdly, even on the sort of traditional side, because I'm with Transworld, which is part of Penguin, which is, you know, the biggest in the world and all that. Even there, I think possibly because we did it ourselves first and it was successful. Frankly, they don't kind of, like, everyone sort of goes, oh, my editors tell me I have to do this and that and the other and stuff. I don't get any of that. I think, to be honest, they're a little bit scared of me just because I'm sort of, they look at me and sort of go, if we annoy him, he's just going to go off and do it himself when we don't need us anymore. So, which is just, it's the joy of kind of having the indie thing with you where, people kind of respect your, that you've done it yourself. And it's a different relationship you have, I think, with the publisher because of that.
Yeah, although I think even all the books I've written, the publishers have been, the editors have been very good. I think in terms of if you trust your editor, the stuff they come back with improves it, and they leave you alone if it's okay. So a good editor will not leap in and change too much.
Yeah,
only if it's going off the rails. So they've obviously been, very successful, those books. And then obviously you've got this new series, which we'll talk about, because this is the one. When I listened to the audiobook, I got sent the first two audiobooks. Didn't know anything about them, Cueve. I hadn't read any, I knew you were writing books and I thought you were writing books about Ireland and this book's about Manchester. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know there was any unusual element in it all. And I started on the second one. I thought, oh, this is really, I'm really gripped by this. And then suddenly there were sort of vampires and stuff in it. And I went, oh, okay. I wasn't expecting that. And it was actually quite joyous because it really wrong-footed me, which it won't for most readers because most readers won't start on the second one. So I went back. I realized, although there's recaps in the second one, I realized this is a thing you should start at the beginning. So there are four of them now, I think, aren't there? But so the first one, it's called The Stranger Times. Do you want to? It's easier for especially with novels that you give a synopsis of what this is, so I don't give too much away.
Yeah, well, basically, for anyone who's a fan of the 14 Times, which I'm a massive fan of, which kind of part of the inspiration is, it's basically The Stranger Times is a newspaper based in Manchester which reports weird and wonderful news from all around the world. And it's quite a sort of low-end, weird, once-a-week type of thing. And they're sort of, the idea is they're initially just reporting these things as, the madness in the world. And then it turns out they start discovering that there are some things going on that are considerably more unusual than they expected. Like, there is magic and stuff in the world. And the sort of editor is the whole idea behind Bancroft is he was like the sort of dark prince of Fleet Street. And then his wife died and he had a breakdown essentially, and he ends up editing this weird newspaper, which he doesn't believe in, but he's determined that it's still going to be a newspaper. And it may be, I think at some point he describes it as, it might be crap, but it's going to be correctly spelled crap. And then it's sort of, they end up then go sort of going off into the kind of getting involved in, shall we say, the machinations of the magical world and all the various different things in it.
What was it that inspired this idea, or what was it that made you want to kind of do something involving the supernatural in this way?
Well, what was weird is because, as I said, the Bunny Books took off and I got an agent and stuff then. And they were like, initially the plan was I was going to write a quote-unquote serious crime book.
Right.
And I remember sitting in my office at the time, my old writing office, and having loads of serious crime book ideas up. And I literally woke up in my flat one morning and my brain was like, do you remember that sitcom idea you had like 10 years ago you wrote about the newspaper? And I can distinctly remember the weird moment of standing in the shower going, oh, yeah, I really like that. It was really good. And then I started walking to my writing office because I never write at home. And I started walking to my writing office through Manchester. And I was like, oh, this is where it should be. This just makes perfect sense. And it was literally a 20-minute walk. And by the end of the walk, I was running up the stairs in this crappy little building to get to my office to start writing things down furiously because it just made sense. Yeah. And then I went to agents like, oh, yeah, you want a serious crime book? Yeah, no, werewolves.
it's you know, but it does feel like such a deeply conceived idea. I mean, the characters are so well thought out and complimentary, and you know, and it's a, you know, it's a gripping book. I'd say it's very, you know, it's funny, especially the between chapters you've got little reports of things that would be in the paper, and those are really, really funny, and there's plenty of humor within the interactions between the characters, but it is sort of gripping and scary. So it feels very, you know, it feels like something you've been working on for many, many years to me. So that's kind of interesting. It's interesting. It's sort of percolating, but maybe in the back.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and then it was, you know, because I think, well, thanks very much. Because one of the big things that I always say when people write about writing comedy is, but in books in particular, is because I've read a lot of, you know, books that were doing comedy stuff, and there's some great ones, obviously, like Chris Brookmeyer's early work when he was more into that was incredible. But when people go wrong, I honestly think is when they're trying to be funny. Like, I always feel bad because people ask about how to write funny a lot when I do events, and it's always, I always feel like the answer is not what they want, which is like, there's a couple of things. Like, one, if you've got a character walking into a room and the only reason they're there is because you've thought of something funny to happen in the room, then nail the door shut, burn down the building. You're going entirely the wrong fucking way. Secondly, as you know this better than I do, but when someone says, how do you do footies? You go, well, basically, I have to get between A and B, and that's the route my brain takes. Like, it doesn't go the conventional way because, which is, you know, as a novelist is great because as you again know, the reality is that's how we do everything in life, and it causes an awful lot of problems outside of writing. So thankfully it works in writing because I can remember being in the supermarket, the most, like, bizarrely with Gary Delaney, who's my old flatmate, and him just being a comedian, and he was just chatting to some woman behind the counter, and I just thought, you are scaring the living shit out of this woman at the cash register just because something was funny to you and you just started talking about it. And this is not what ordinary people do.
I think that's true. And, you know, I think you're right. You've hit the nail on the head with it because, you know, it is quite unusual. I mean, in terms of plays and novels, even when they're funny, when they're billed as funny, then, you know, to a comedian, you go, well, this one joke every 15 minutes or something. This isn't funny, and it's you know, often it is a bit nailed on. This book, you know, the humor is, it comes out of a lot of it comes out of character. A lot, obviously, it's a funny premise to have a 14 times where it turns out that some of the stuff is true and some of the stuff isn't, and obviously that attracts. It gives you the opportunity to bring in a lot of eccentric characters as well, which are terrifically good.
The genre is just a delight for that because you can just do wonderful weird. It's sort of one of those things, as long as it makes sense in the world. Like, you can't just do anything. You have to sort of still have, like, it doesn't have to obey the rules of the real world, but it has to obey the rules of its own world, if you like. But in that, you can do so much stuff because there is. I mean, actually, the hardest thing to write in the books, Maria, about the articles that are between some of the chapters, those are actually the hardest thing to write by a considerable distance in the book, because it's very hard to come up with something weirder than as actually stuff that really in the world. Like, amazing example that was. I tried to, do you remember when the 5G thing was happening and people were saying it was causing COVID and all that? I tried to make up a spoof version of that by trying to pick a technology in the past and go, right, train, like railways, that's a big thing. And I tried to come up with a spoof thing about railways and how they thought it was going to cause something. And then I literally Googled it. And they did think that if women got on the first railways, their wombs were going to explode. Like, that was a real belief at the time. And you're just like, I literally couldn't have made up something as weird as the reality there. But that kind of world is brilliant for, and particularly actually the great thing with kind of fantasy stuff is it works brilliantly for short stories, which I do as well in that genre, much better than crime. Crime short stories I always find are really hard. And even I've read some crime short stories and they're always very difficult to do because it doesn't suit how the genre goes, because you need kind of, you need an investigation in crime and it just, you can't do it in a short space of time. Whereas fantasy, you just have one idea you can work with and you just do as long as that idea takes to do. So it's just, for that kind of thing, it's much more freeing as a genre as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it's great. And so with the, I mean, I think what's lovely about all of the characters, you know, we get depth with them. We get a lot, and very, you know, without it being sort of, you know, layered on thick, we get their backstories, you know, little snippets of their backstories, which obviously, and this is just in the first book, I'm sure that that a lot of these will develop over the series. But as you say, the editor character is an amazing big character. Hannah is who's the new recruit, the not Tina. Yeah. let's call her not Tina. She has an interesting backstory that we sort of get to get out in little doses throughout the book. But she's the normal character. She's the most normal.
She's the one who basically brings you into the world, which I think is something you probably need to do with the kind of fantasy stuff. You need someone who sort of starts at the point the reader is, so that when they discover stuff, their reaction is what the readers would be. They're almost like their guide.
Exactly.
By the way, I don't know if you noticed, but the one you started reading before you went back to the first one, there's a character based on the late, great Ian Cognito in it.
Oh, right. I saw you. Yeah. I saw the dedication to him. Right.
Basically, there's a character, Cogs, in it, which is an homage, which I weirdest thing I've ever read. One of the weirdest things I have to do was I sent a copy to his sons because it was like, shit, better make sure they're okay with this. And luckily they loved it, because the whole idea was it's kind of like a weird look, because he's basically he's a bloke who's trapped. He's forced to live on a boat in the middle of a canal in Manchester because he basically cheated on a river goddess, and now he's forced to live on water and he's cursed to only be able to tell the truth. So he's a brilliant, like, I wanted to have like a Huggy Bear type source character. And then I just sort of, it was around when I started writing that book, was around the time Ian died. And weirdly sort of had this idea then I was telling my editor at lunch stories about Ian Cognito, because we all have the Ian Cognito stories, you know, like there's a plethora of them for everyone. And I was just, at some point I was telling them that, and at some point it just sort of became the character. And it's probably the most fun character to write in it. And he's like, it's him and a dog. Cause you know, he always had the dog, and he was him and the dog living on the boat. And the dog is it also talks. And it was basically a bloke who used to be human, who got transformed into a dog. And this sort of odd couple living on a boat, but they end up, as people said, ends up being weirdly a very kind of sweet relationship, because it's a nice romance, because he can't lie to anybody. So like, he can't, it's a great sort of switch on how men are, where he can't, you know, he tells him he loves them because he can't not. Like, he tells him he loves them, like, ah, crap, because he couldn't not do it. And so that was a sort of weird, the only time I've ever done that, like, used a real person for a thing, but I just wanted it, but it just sort of made sense.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, comedians in this world, like you're saying, this just the fact that we're all like a little bit off of what the reality of most people's lives are, I think that would probably work quite well. And it probably does explain why, because this newspaper would bring in anyone who was able to work for this newspaper for a considerable amount of time would have to put up with this, you know, bolshy kind of incredible editor and the weird people in the print room, and they'd have to be able to deal with that, which most people couldn't. So it immediately means you've got a realistic group of like incredibly disparate I love the relationship between the editor and its Grace, isn't it, who's his assistant who doesn't want him to swear. And so he's all trying to avoid swearing. He gets fined if he swears too much. He gets a certain number of swears and a swear board in the exact one. Yeah. So yeah.
And that was weirdly, even just for writing points, but weirdly that was because the way the character is, where he would have been, like, logically, if that character's so aggressive, he'd have been swearing left, right, and center. And it was kind of one of these things, you go, I don't really want that much swearing in the book. And oddly, just trying to find a way around that became a real feature of the book. It's kind of those things, yes. You know, where you put yourself in a corner and actually the answer you come up with is way better than what you had. Because yes. Literally yeah. had this thing where he's trying to find creative ways to non-swear, which is a lot more fun to write than someone just effing and blinding, really.
It's true. I wrote a sitcom for Frank Skinner, like back many years ago, like the early 2000s. And we did a pilot and we got sort of certain distance with it. And then he decided not to do it himself, actually, at the end. But that was because it was ITV and because it was Frank, it was exactly the same thing. So we had like his brother's wife didn't allow him to swear in the house. So he would come up with interesting ways to get around that. Not quite the same, but it is. But yeah, it was. It does remind me of that. And it is, you know, it is liberating in a way. And it makes, you know, obviously with all of these things, and I know that there are possibly TV stuff in the works, but you know it's worth thinking about that anyways. You want to have as much of a readership as possible. I think you know young adults and kids would, you know, teenagers would love this book. It's a bit it's quite full on, but I think it's okay for like 13, 14 plus.
Oh yeah, well, it was one of those things where like the amount of people like, because I weirdly occasionally gets described as horror because I don't like horror. Like I've not seen almost any of the big horror movies and stuff because I'm a complete wuss. Like I literally, when I lived with Gary, him and my now wife would go to the cinema and see a horror movie and me and Sarah would go and see the latest Disney thing and we'd meet in the car park because neither of us want to watch a horror movie. So it was weird when people describe it. I mean, there's a little bit of elements in it, but I don't think it's that much. But the other thing as well is like, teenagers are reading Stephen King and everything. We all sort of forget this, that we all think, well, you shouldn't read anything with any sex or violence before you're 18. And the reality is bookworms know way more weird stuff about the world than people who are just sitting home watching YouTube because there's so much stuff you get out of books. But yeah, and it's also, to be honest, it's not even so much that. It's not worrying about, you know, commercial. It's just, you know, swearing can just be a bit boring when you're writing it. It just feels a bit like in my bunny book, like the Irish books, there was a lot more swearing in the first one. And it just sort of got less, or Bunny has creative ways of swearing when it's him because it's just more interesting. Like actually in the first book, there was a C-bomb for anyone who's a bit in the book, and it made sense in the context of where it was and stuff. And weirdly, it was fine. Then we did the audio book, and genuinely, I listened to the audiobook and went, oh, Jesus, someone shouting that word loudly in your car is a bit much. So I actually went back. And again, it's the joys of being your own publisher. I went back and changed it just because it genuinely, when you listen to it on audio, felt like, oh, that really is kind of, you know, it's weird when it's on the page, you're kind of choosing to read it. But when it's in the audiobook, it's kind of like it's coming at you. It's one of these things. I think as you go on as a writer, you realize that the swearing, while it's kind of, you always want to write real dialogue. After a while, you realise it's a bit tedious and you just do less and less of it, I think.
Yeah. Well, again, I was just talking to Armando DiNucci this week and on the podcast. And, you know, that obviously that was the same for them. They need with Malcolm Tucker, they sort of needed a character who swore, but it would have just become too, you know, because that's the reality of it. But the only way to make that not become just abrasive and horrible was to come up with these fantastically elaborate ways of swearing, which is in the end what makes that, you know, it's not all that makes that show the success it is, but it's the big part of that, the thick of it, is the amazing swearing in it. And so anything that makes you, I guess, just sort of think, let's make this better, let's think of a new way of doing this, let's limit ourselves, or I found when I started doing podcasts, you know, doing sketches on podcasts, I did a show called As It Occurs to Me, and you know, I was allowed to do anything I wanted. And so, for the first couple of weeks, you would go, right, let's push back the boundaries and let's see what happens. And then, about 3 or 4 weeks, you go, yeah, but now I'm allowed to. It's not as much fun, but also, there's a reason that you would need some boundaries. And you know, it's kind of more fun to kind of peg yourself in than to allow absolute freedom for creativity, I think, which is really interesting with this.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry?
and some, well, less awesome. Like, what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So how many you've done? Is there three or four of the Stranger Times books?
Is it the fourth Stranger Times book just came out. Relight My Fire just came out recently, and then there's going to be obviously more, and there's all the short stories and stuff as well on the podcast, the Stranger Times podcast. But people always ask me like, how many books are you going to do? Because it was a weird. I think it's because the first deal was for three books. It's an odd thing where several people thought it was a trilogy. Like, we literally never used that word. Bear in mind, I've screwed up with the Dublin trilogy. And I was like, I've literally never used the word trilogy. I never intended to just write three books. Because, like, weirdly, I'm like four books in now. And honestly, it kind of feels like I'm still getting started with it. Like, that's how much. I mean, there's so many ideas. I mean, it's like that. It's like that classic thing, you know, it's like stand-up. People always come over after gigs and go, I've got one for you. You know, like, let me just stop you there. Let me just check what words are in this because I'm pretty sure I'm not going to like them. And then, but like, as an author, you know, I've got an idea for a book. People come to, I've got an idea for a book. You could write it and then we could split the money. It's like going, I was like, can I just show you my phone and how many ideas for books I currently have? Like, literally, I could just keep scrolling and we'll be here for an hour. You know, and it's even at the minute, actually, I'm writing a book with my wife. And which is, it's a kind of fantasy thing, but it's actually bizarrely based on essentially a German folktale. We were in Germany doing book tours and they brought us around doing some tourism stuff. And we just had this idea. And people always ask, like, how do you decide to write a book? And the reality is you have the idea. And when you write the book is you write the book because the idea did not go away. Like, if it keeps bothering you, you know yourself, like, and you have any ideas, like, you can love something for a week, but then after a week you're like, meh. But if it just doesn't go away and it just keeps annoying you, and when you can't sleep at night, your brain keeps working on it, then you're going to have to write the thing. Because I've had loads of ideas for books and stuff over the last, because you know yourself, when you're working on something, the first thing your brain does, brilliant, here's an idea for something else. Let's do this instead. Let's do this. And you're like, oh no, this is what we're doing. So you end up stockpiling these things up. And it is this sort of it's a weird thing, the system where I have kind of like a queue of books that I'm going to write. Like, I'm doing this secret project and then I'm supposed to write the next bunny book. And the next bunny book is literally, there's three ideas. And one of them was ahead up until about Christmas. Then I had a bit more of the other one. So that's now ahead. And it's like literally a race between the three ideas to see which one gets to be written next. And then there's the next Stranger Times book, which I've definitely decided what that's about. And I'm very excited to write that. And then I know what's coming after that and after that. And it's a sort of weird thing where, especially when you're writing series, you end up with like this queue of things like taxis on the runway.
It's great. You've got so many ideas and so much is coming. How long does it then take you? I mean, I know this is a difficult thing to quantify because obviously there's, you know, there's the thought process beforehand. But when you sit down to write these books, how long are they taking to actually complete?
When I actually start writing, weirdly, the last Stranger Times book, Relight My Fire, was the longest book I've ever written, not by a massive amount, but it also took the shortest amount of time. Part of that was we just moved house and so everything was delayed. So I ended up just needing to get it done quickly. And then weirdly, I just wrote every day and I was writing and writing and writing. I got it done in like a remarkably short space of time for a book I'm really happy with. But it's sort of one of these things where it's like maybe 2 to 3 months, because usually what happens is at the start, you're like sort of, you're figuring out, especially like this new book is because it's a new, I remember when I first started writing The Stranger Times and I was like, oh, this isn't working because like the bunny books are so much faster to write. And then like literally when I was talking to my wife and she's like, yeah, but you understand the world of the bunny books. You don't understand the world of these books yet. So you have to have, like, it's going to take longer because you're figuring stuff out. And you're like, oh, yeah. And it's always, so the first book in a series, and I realize it's probably going to take a lot longer than, like, the second or third book will. And so, yeah, but when you get going, it's, the actual writing can take, you know, a couple of months, weeks, you know, episodes, 8-9 weeks, depending on the size of the book and how complex the idea is. But yeah, as you said, that's kind of, people always get confused by that, because the reality is you've been working on it in your head for a couple of months, a few months beforehand. And you're, I'm always like taking down notes. So when I come to it and stuff, so I sort of have bits of the puzzle. And then, like, it starts off, you're writing quite slow at the start. And then at the end, you'd be cranking out a load because you know where you're going and you're excited and you're moving forward really fast. But it's not like a straight line. It is definitely a weird kind of curve.
And, you know, I suppose once you've got the idea, and also once you've really got the characters, and again, I think the characters are the, not the only strength of this, but I think are the real heart of this. But once you've got characters that really work, they sort of start to genuinely sort of write themselves, don't they? So, you know, I was talking to Sarah Pascoe about this, but, you know, the characters start doing stuff that you're not necessarily expecting, and you sort of roll with it, and the book changes as a result of them rather than of you.
Well, yeah, you just sort of let them go, and especially when you know who they are and stuff. But even when I'm finding out who they are, what you generally do is you get them stuck in a room together, and you frankly find them something to disagree about or something. And it's amazing when people, because that's how you find out who anybody is. When you're, you know, when you agree or disagree on stuff, that's how you figure out who people are in your own life. And that's how you figure them out in books as well. And you can kind of write that, and then you can go back and, you know, sometimes you can even cut it out if you want to later on. But you just need to find out who they are. And you kind of, without being wanky about it, you need to give them time to sort of decide who they are themselves almost. You know, like if you sort of write down prescriptively, this person's going to be this and this person's going to be that, then it doesn't work. And things like bizarrely, Bunny McGarry, who's the main character in the Dublin books, he was supposed to be a small character. Genuinely was. He wasn't supposed to be a main character. And he turned up and wouldn't bloody leave. Like, literally, as soon as I started writing him, he was clearly just great fun to write because the way he speaks and the way he acts. But it was also instantly you go, this guy is so alive. And like instantly, and you can tell if someone's going to be a fan of the books if they read the first book and their big response is, oh, Bunny and stuff. And because that's really became what the books became about. And it was his story because it's just, and there's other characters good, but he's just this, you know, incredibly vibrant character when you're writing them. And like I've written, I mean, because there's a McGarry Stateside, which is a series of books in America involving Bunny going to America, and obviously enough, and there's four of them. So I've written like 11 books with Bunny in it. And honestly, and this isn't, because I've always, you know, I'm not in the least bit tired of writing them. I just find them so much fun and fascinating, and there's places we can go with them. Because I was always, when I started, I was always terrified of the idea of like, oh, I've got to crank out another one of those books. You know what I mean? Like, because there are authors I've spoken to who have like series with one main character and they frankly get bored of the character. I think there are some, without naming names and stuff, there are people who've got like series where possibly they're not writing them anymore. like ghostwriters and stuff, because they just get bored of doing them. And I was like, I'd never use a ghostwriter on principle, but also I never want to write something where I'm like, oh God, I've got to crank out another one of those things because I've got a mortgage. Do you know what I mean? Like I always, I never wanted to be that guy. In the same way as a stand-up, I never wanted to be worried about jonglers kicking me off their thing because I needed to make my mortgage payments and stuff. And thankfully, I was never that in with jonglers, so that worked out well.
It's the dream, though, isn't it? If you're doing exactly what you want to do, and you're loving it, you can stop whenever you want to stop. It's and they're doing well, you know, they're doing well enough for you to carry on regardless. So you know, having that level of dedication, I suppose, is very important. And that commitment to it, and that, you know, I think that's completely unique, but to be having that many ideas and having them queued up to come out, but it's a wonderful place to be as a writer if you know I've got the next thing lined up after this one.
Yeah, and the freedom to sort of go, you know, I essentially can set my own schedule and stuff. Because even with like Trans World and Penguin and stuff, we can, like, the next books, the timings change. Because basically, without giving that much away, the next Stranger Times book, because they kind of weirdly, by accident almost, go like the first one, the second one happens like 2 months after the first, and sort of roughly they go in that period, and then Relight My Fire happens at Halloween, and then the next one was logically going to be Christmas, and I have an idea for a Christmas thing that I love, like it's the ultimate anti-Christmas book, like literally starts off with a quadruple murder, but it is going to be genuinely very Christmassy in a very weird way. And I explained to my agent, he went, that's great, but also no one's going to release a Christmas book in January and February when your books currently come out. So it's going to have to come out in like October. So we're going to have to move the schedule around. But luckily I'm in a position where we can do that. And yeah, I mean, it's one of these things where we're kind of not unique, but unusual in the sense that we have a very unique thing where we talk to our fans. Like we send out emails, like newsletters, like people do, but people email back. And what happens is they actually get response from my wife who manages the whole company. And so we sort of speak to people a lot. So we have a sort of unique relationship where our fans really are like hardcore fans where we've spoken to them a lot and it's a genuine thing. But because of that, these people are kind of like really lovely, loyal fans and they're great. And you don't need millions of people to love you. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. We're both stand-up comedians. That's clearly what we want. Whatever damaged us in life that made us wanted to be that way. But the great thing about now in the world is, like with podcasts and all this stuff, so you know this better than me. You don't need everybody. You just need the people that you can find your own tribe, as the Americans love to say. And once you've got them, there's a great freedom because they sort of go, yeah, we like your stuff. Just do what you want. We'll follow you. And as long as you don't completely go off the deep end, we're going to stick with you. And that's brilliant where that's the new artistic freedom is having a certain amount, just enough people to like you to allow you to do what the hell you want. And that's luckily where I am, I think.
Well, it's really terrific. It's a very enjoyable book, Stranger Times, and I'm sure the whole series is. I do like it enough that I will definitely listen to the rest of the second one hopefully carry on from there. So, you know, I think that's it. And once you've got a fan, when you've got this many books, Ian Rankin was on recently, and obviously once someone suddenly goes, oh, I like this guy, 25 books to read. So every sale is potentially 25 sales, which is terrific. The audiobook is fantastic as well. You don't do it yourself. You've got a fantastic actor. Yeah. I think I would have to call him.
We won like the British Fantasy Award for a thing because between that and the all the comedians doing the short stories on the podcast, people sort of really like that. And Brendan does an amazing job. And it's weird because it's an Irish middle. People are starting, they just try and because we have our other books are done by an Irish guy called Morgan C. Jones. He was a comic. I don't know if you ever met him, but he's one of the top voiceover guys in Ireland. He's brilliant. When we came to Stranger Times books, we wanted him to do them because our fans loved Morgan. Morgan was unavailable because of a health thing, I think it was. And so they went and got another Irish middle-aged guy. And we're like, oh, no, we didn't. That wasn't what we wanted. We didn't want someone who just looks and sounds like me. But the reality is we got like a load of different people to do things. And Brendan was just brilliant. And weirdly, he hasn't even done that many audiobooks, but the man does a superb job to the point where it's annoying. His reviews are better than mine. It's really. And I kind of know him now. And frankly, every time I go back to Dublin, me and him go out in the beer together because it's a good work meeting. He does an amazing job, though. And people do. We're quite unusual. We sell like proportionately so much more audiobooks than like most people. Our percentage of audiobooks compared to those books. Compared to other people's kind of sales between audio and ebook and thing, audiobooks I think are our biggest seller because people have really latched on to the combination. And I think the combination of my stuff with somebody who's just going full on and giving it full welly as a performance and doing a brilliant job, just works really well. And he's, to be fair, and you know what Mancunians are like, I love them, but they're a little bit touchy. The finest piece of compliment Brendan never got was Mancunian mates of mine going, his Manchester accent is flawless. And he just sort of has an ear like where he can do this.
He does.
And
it's
very impressive.
It is very impressive. It's a great way to enjoy them if you want to go that way. But I do prefer the audiobooks. Generally speaking, for everything, so it's and I think it shows again. I know you are developing them all of this stuff for TV, but it does sort of show. I mean, your scripted background and your ear for dialogue, it really it shows off you know, I was just listening to this going, oh my God, I didn't know you'd got a TV deal, but I thought obviously there will be a TV project in this if they can afford to put it on. Because it's, you know, it must be quite satisfying to have gone from writing scripts for TV that people were, you know, may not necessarily leaping on and putting on TV, yeah, to doing this, and then them coming to you, I guess.
Actually, the strange, this was, you, I don't normally tell this story, but you'll get this better than I always think. The weirdest thing about it, the Stranger Times, I think we just signed the publishing, and traditional publishing like takes like, you know, it was like 18 months before the book came out. And my agent was going, you need to come down to London to talk to the TV agent because we're getting a lot of TV interest. And I was like, I don't, how have we got TV? The book hasn't come out. They went, oh, there's buzz, and there's lots of people want to have a chat about it. It was like, but, and I went down for this meeting, and like, you know, the classic Soho meeting when you're in the agency was like going, can I just ask, how are people interested? And she just went, it's out there. And I went, that doesn't make any sense. That's not, like, I literally had things I'd written and like that were out, I was pushing, nobody was interested. And literally it was like, it's out there. And I had like, yeah. Even weirder, loads of American companies were really interested in it. I probably shouldn't, but bizarrely, the guy's company, the guy who did the last Batman film, his company were, yeah, interested. And my agent, bless it, went, now, this is a bit unusual, but hear me out. Their big idea is they want to do it with puppets. Now, I know what you think with puppets, but like, they've sent you a taster tape with this amazing stuff people are doing with puppets now. Very different than you've ever seen before. And I was like, okay, great, yeah. And like, bear in mind, I'd written kids' TV, so I'd actually written for puppets and stuff before. And like, there was sort of, and then they wanted a meeting and stuff, and that was one I kind of went, and like, literally 6 months later, I was in the pub with my agent, and he just went, can I just ask, do you remember that sent you the whole tape with the puppets? And I went, yeah, never watched it. Yeah. He's like, that's what I thought. Because I could just tell you're telling me. Like, I don't like, keep an open mind. I'm like going, I'm not, I'm an open mind as anyone. I'm not having my book done by fucking puppets.
I've got a lot of puppets of you. I can have a crack. I'll have a crack at it with my, yeah, puppets. I mean, and I'll send.
I'm open to new ideas, obviously, Richard. Do let me know. I'll pass them on.
You can write a magic carrot in there.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I love a puppet. I've got I had like a full-size monkey ventriloquist doll. That weird, yeah. This, I always have a phrase how to say, but Nina Conti, I gave her a lift home once and she came into the house and she had a go on my puppet. And right. It was freaky because she was doing the monkey voice. Right. Like she was doing monk and all that. And yeah. It was amazing. Because I was, and I'm a big fan of that stuff. Every time I've seen Nina work, literally within 30 seconds, I'm like, I fully believe they are two different things, and I'm loving it, yeah, every time. But yeah,
she is amazing.
I mean, it's one of those things, isn't it? Because, you know, again, it's a classic TV thing. You know that thing, every few years, you kind of came round, if you're in TV development meetings, somebody was having a go at doing something with puppets because puppets' time had come. And the Muppets, yeah, everyone grew up on the Muppets and everyone kept trying to do the next thing with puppets. And they never happened because it always, you did a taster tape and it was always like, yeah, no, it's still not going to happen.
Great. Look, well, if people are interested, I mean, you write under both Keith MacDonald, which is, because you're Irish, is spelt with all different letters than it sounds. So it's C-A-I-M-H.
Hang on. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not going to comment. It's been commented before, but so those are some of your books are written under your first name. And then was there a reason you chose to go for a different pen name for?
Yeah, hilariously, my editor's a lovely man, but he's also the most, he's like, he's that level of sort of posh English that you wonder how he functions. Like, do you know that me? But we had a meeting with him and he was obviously, myself and my agent editor already said, we'll use like initials because it makes sense. It's different genres. We'll use different names anyway, but they were terrified of Queeve. And right. Like they were literally going, and I've always remember, bless him, he's in this, we're having lunch and he's going about the name. He's obviously trying to bring it up. He went, I was just wondering if we maybe could, and we don't have to, but if we could maybe do, and you know, this is just what we can talk about. And I was like, sorry, literally, I remember saying to Ed afterwards going, I honestly thought he was going to pass out from a lack of oxygen before he got to the end of the sentence. Before he got, like, because Ed just stopped and went, we've already discussed it. We're happy to use initials CK if that's what you want. He's like, okay, good. It's like, literally, we thought he was going to pass out just because he was like, I'm telling an Irish bloke to not use his name in his native language. And it almost, you can almost see it occur to him halfway through the sentence, how bad this was.
Well, it was worth it just for that. But yeah, so McDonald's always there if you're looking through. But you'll find all the books. Do check out. I mean, it's such. Do you think you'll return to stand up, or is this now you're just too busy with this?
I kind of, people always ask. I kind of more miss stand up comedians, if you know what I mean. I more miss sort of hanging out with stand ups, and because there's all the travel, frankly, as you know well.
Yeah.
But no, I think in all honesty, I'm just better at this. Like it's the kind of this. I've done enough stuff in my life that I've sort of. I was, I got given out to by Milliken recently for somebody asked me about how I referred to my stand up career, and she was like, "You sort of say this like you weren't very good at it. You were like I think she was kind of like going, if you were anywhere near as bad as you somehow suggest you were, A, you wouldn't have made a living, and B, I wouldn't have had your support act. Stop telling people you weren't good at it." So I was all right. But just this, I kind of feel like it's I don't, that way I don't know where my ceiling is. I feel like I'm getting better at it. I'm enjoying it. And I feel like I can do more with it. And frankly, I like the process of this because it takes me out of it almost, if you know what I mean. Do you know what I mean? When you're a stand-up, it's always, it's kind of about you. Even if you're talking about the Middle East, you're still talking about you, really. And I just like the fact that I can go into these worlds and just invent the world and kind of then set it free, and people will hopefully enjoy it. But they can be reading the book around the world while I'm asleep or watching telly, and I don't have to be directly involved in the process.
Yeah, it's the dream. I think it is. I don't know. Well, as I get older, I sort of think, I'd be interested to see. I'm going to go off on another stand-up tour after I've toured the podcast, and it'll be interesting to see how I feel about stand-up after that tour, I think, and also how the audiences feel about me doing stand-up again, because I've been away from stand-up for a little bit. So I think as you get older as well, you sort of do think, if I had, I don't know if I've just got the staying power to do the writing anymore. I'd used to write lots of scripts, and I have written books, but not novels. I would love to write novels, but I just, we'll see. But it's very inspirational.
When you sort of head gets into the space, because I thought I never could do it. And then the greatest thing you learn from writing your first novel is the fact you can write a novel. And then you sort of learn after that. But it is, I thought I could never do it, and I'm surprised. And then people sort of keep telling me, "Oh, you've written so many books." It's like, yeah, I enjoy doing it and I get bored. So, what else am I going to do? Start running a marathon and stuff? It's not really my, the dog only needs to be walked once a day.
Well, look, it's a real inspiration, and it's great. It's great to see. It's lovely. I think with the comedy community, as people have an idea of us all being backstabbing and ambitious, and there's an element of that to some stand-ups, I think. But I think most stand-ups are delighted when someone, especially if it means you're going away from stand-up, I guess, delighted when someone else has a success. And it's so impressive what you've done, I have to say. And it's, in such a short time as well, to have created this amount of work is brilliant. And it's really interesting to hear about, you setting up your own company and doing it that way, and your own publishing house is really brilliant. I do ask all my guests if they've read anything recently they'd like to recommend. I know on your website you like to recommend other people's books and work. Is there any books you've been reading recently? I mean, if you get time to read, I don't know how you would get time.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm always trying to. What was I reading recently? Oh, there's a book I'm really enjoying, but I can't remember the name of the guy who wrote it. But yeah, it's a new one to me. Mark Stay's book, it's got this lovely idea of a sort of World War II, kind of weirdly, basically magic in World War II with sort of witches in Middle England kind of thing, which is a very sweet idea. And I was reading Simon Beckett. Bizarrely, I never really liked these sort of things because I said I'm squeamish, but it's a story about guys who deals with dead bodies, and it's kind of him as the detective kind of thing. And I've discovered that weirdly, I could never watch an autopsy on television, but turns out I can read about them fine and they're very interesting. As long as I don't have to actually physically see it, I'm happy to talk with some 2 pages explaining maggots. But those are great books. He's quite interesting, actually, because he's massive in Europe. He's an English guy. I think he lives in Sheffield. Right. Books are set over here, but they just hit massively. He sold millions of books, but weirdly, he sold them in Germany. And so, I mean, he sells well over here, but nowhere near that level. But he's a massive star in the rest of the thing. And his books are brilliantly written. Okay, so cool. Those would be another one to suggest if you're more crime, yeah.
Cool. And I do like the way Manchester is the heart of this series. I've read a lot of books set in Edinburgh, which is a great place to set something, but it is absolutely perfect. And it's lovely to see Manchester being admittedly, you know, not hugely respectfully or not always respectfully, but there's a lot about rain in there. But it's great to see Manchester given, you know, I love Manchester and it's a brilliant city. So it's great.
It genuinely has a really strong vibe that makes sense as a sort of thing. And it was, as you say, there's weirdly not that many books set here. I mean, Edinburgh's great for crime and I get it. And there's so many. But like, there's a lot of brilliant books set in London. But I'm like, there's enough brilliant books set in London. Let's set them other places.
Yeah, I think for werewolves and vampires, Manchester makes sense. So it makes sense. Brilliant. Lovely to see you again, Queen. Thank you very much. Do go and read all of C.K. McDonald's and Queen McDonald's books. And thank you very much for coming on the show. And thank you to Chris Evans and Ben Evans, as always, for their fantastic work behind the scenes. See you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh yeah, I know all the cool words, and would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.